why don't we start with Tony Fernandez? I mean, that's a big one, right? I mean, that's, you know, that's a sad one for people of a certain vintage, and I'm of that vintage. This is a hard one. You know, it's the, I mean, he was one of the greatest players the franchise has ever seen. He played here four different times. He holds all kinds of records, level of excellence. And it's, I guess we'll try to put it into words. Like, there were other players who were, for lack of a better term, better than him. You know, a few players the Jays have had who may have done more, but there was just something about him where, you know, buddies are texting me and I'm texting them about, remember that sidearm flip? Like, there was just something about him that made him stand out. Some of it's quantifiable, some of it's like more intangible, but he was a guy that, you know, back in the 80s, especially that first stint, everybody just loved him. He was as good a shortstop as there was in the game back then, and this was a hard one. You know, the last we had seen, it appeared he had maybe stabilized and maybe was improving, and obviously it wasn't meant to be.
Yeah, so for someone like me who wasn't around for Tony Fernandez, who, yeah, like for me, it's basically going off of listening to what other people say and then small amounts of different highlights. Is there a way that you would try to describe him as a player to someone, again, who really wasn't around for any of his prime?
I'll try, and cut me off if I get too long here. So first of all, when he came up in 83 or 84, I think he came up more in 84, like he was about the skinniest major leaguer you've ever seen in your life. And he's 6'2", 6'3", but he couldn't have weighed more than 165 pounds. And he had a way of holding the bat in the batter's box, switch hitter. It almost looked like the bat was going to slip out of his hands. Like, he was holding it so loosely, like limp-wristed almost. And so back then, I'm like 16, 17 years old, and you're playing ball with your friends, and we would all imitate his batting stance. Didn't matter if you were a right-handed batter or a left-handed batter, because he was a switch hitter. We would all imitate his stance, like a slight crouch, and the bat looks like it's going to fall out of his hands, and then all of a sudden, like a whip, just bang through the strike zone. And he had line drives all over the place. He ran well. I wouldn't say he was a graceful runner, but he ran well. But really, as much as he did have good offensive seasons, you know, triples and steals and so forth, it was his defense. I'd never seen anybody play shortstop like that before. I had seen Ozzie Smith and Gary Templeton and Cal Ripken and some of the other great guys. But Tony, and I'm sure you've talked about this with other people, he'd go in the hole, like, so he'd range far to his right, over towards the third baseline. He'd go in the hole, backhand the ball, transfer it to his bare hand, and he would sidearm flip it, like just a little snap of the wrist, and the ball would seemingly be in the air forever, and it always got there just before the runner did. It was accurate, and it wasn't a rocket. Tony didn't set his feet, come over the top, and throw a missile like some infielders do. It was a flip. That's the only word I can think to describe it, and it always got there. And he could also go up the middle to his left and throw across his body remarkably well. He was just a very agile, different kind of athlete. And his personality, not to jump ahead too much, like sometimes he was happy, sometimes he seemed sad or brooding almost, but he was a kind, gentle man. You know, in the 80s, when he came up, I was in high school. When he was great, I was in university. When he came back in 93, I was doing Jays Talk on The Fan. And when he came back again in 98, I think it was, and was a hard-hitting third baseman, I was the Blue Jay broadcaster on TSN. So, like, I saw him at all different parts of his career and all different parts of my life, and he was a kind soul. He really was, and he was a special player. He was a really, really good player.
I think that a lot of times the players that resonate the most with us are the ones that we imitate when we're younger. Like, they say that, you know, music, when you listen to music when you're 15, 16, that's the music that shapes you. That's the music you listen to for the rest of your life. And I think that's the same way with athletes where, you know, when we're all doing this stuff, when we're all starting to pretend, whether it's home playing street hockey or in your driveway shooting a basketball and pretending like the shot clock is running out, or like you just said, where you're playing baseball with your friends, like, those are the ones I think that impact you. So, to have a player like that who, would have shaped the way that kids are holding a baseball bat. I think like those are the kind of legacies that last. Like, that's the stuff that just, I think, like, stands above all else.
And the flip was something, too. Like, again, the offense was something. But if you, you know, defense is what really stood out about him. And I was a left-handed first baseman, so I couldn't imitate anything that he did. But, like, every kid you knew, other than me, would I would be the kid catching the flips at first base. Every kid would go in the hole and try to do it, what Tony did. There also seemed to be, because he was quiet, because he was thoughtful, because he was spiritual, like he was different than George Bell and Lloyd Mosby and some of the other guys on the team, and they were all wonderful in their own way. That was a very exciting time for Blue Jay fans. An expansion team in 77, not a good team until 83, and then good from 83 right through 93. When those teams got good in the mid-80s, When they got Bell, when Barfield came up, when Mosby came up, when Upshaw drove in 100 runs, when Dave Steeb arrived, when Tony Fernandez arrived, it was unbelievably exciting because they had been so bad in their expansion years, and now they were up there competing with the Yankees and the Red Sox. And Tony Fernandez was a big part of that. And he would hit in all different parts of the order again. But there almost seemed to be something vulnerable about him. Like, he was more accessible to us. He wasn't like, you know, the bombastic George Bell or the gregarious Lloyd Mosby. He was a quiet, thoughtful, and again, as I said, sometimes almost appeared to be sad sometimes, yet other times he had the biggest smile in the world on his face. And I think he just seemed a little more, you know, like a little closer to us. We could relate to him a little better, and we wondered about him. And he was just very different on many levels, and he was a really special player. He really was.
I think that's all really well said, and it's hard to pivot out of stuff like this, but I got to ask you about the Astros stuff that happened over the weekend, because it's just such a big story, the way that Rob Manfred has handled this. I don't know if you saw the interview with Carl Ravich or if you just saw the media conference down in Atlanta or how you ingested some of this stuff, but do you have a feel as to or an opinion on how Rob Manfred has handled this so far, not only in the punishment, but now with the PR fallout?
Well, let me go back to the Astros press conference, which I know is a little bit older, and I'm sure you and Ben talked about this last week. I don't think that could have been handled much worse than it was. And I've been around the Astros a lot through ESPN, and especially in the playoffs, ESPN Radio, the last 3 years, because they've been great, obviously. So I've seen them a lot in October. And there's just a general, and you'd think it would have gone away by now, there's a general, we didn't do anything wrong, we're bulletproof, we know what we're doing, and there's an arrogance about the organization, and it was handled poorly. Bregman and Altuve shouldn't have come out for 15 seconds each and then left. And Jim Crane showed no accountability, totally absolved the players of all wrongdoing, said they got rid of the two guys they needed to get rid of, and let's move on. And that's not the way to handle it. And when you've done what these guys have done, you got to take some punches here, and they're not very good at doing that. In terms of Rob Manfred, I'm a little on the fence on this, and I'm not sure this is what you're going to want to hear. Like, and I remember talking to Scotty Mack a few weeks ago on air, and he was like, take away the championship, vacate the championship. And it didn't feel right to me, and it still kind of doesn't, although I don't have much of a reason for saying that. The only reason I would say is, like, what if we come out in 2 weeks and we find out that the Red Sox did XYZ in 2018, and it wasn't quite as bad as what the Astros did, but it was still bad. You know, it's a slippery slope when you start taking away championships and that sort of thing. In terms of immunity for the players, I don't like it, but I don't think he had a way of getting the information without giving immunity. Like, he's not a district attorney. He's not police. And I think there's only so much they can do. And I think he was afraid of getting into a war with the Players Association. I think what they wanted to do was find out as much of the truth as they could. And they felt the way to do it was to grant immunity to the players. I would love to see it different. I just don't know, J.D., how they actually would have done that. I don't think they had the power to do that. I think they're afraid of lawsuits. I think they're afraid of work stoppages. I think they're afraid of battles with the Players Association. And ultimately, I think baseball and the Players Association, they're going to have to sit down at the table and get on the same page about this stuff, like they eventually finally did about steroids. I don't think baseball can do everything it wants to alone. So I don't know if that answers your question. I wish it could have been harsher in certain ways. I wish the players could have been punished in certain ways. But I think baseball said, ultimately, our end game here is to find out what happened and prevent it from happening again. And I'm not sure they could have done that without conceding in the areas that they did.
I I think you're bang on in that it is complicated. You're like, whenever people do bring up the stripping them of the championship, it's like, okay, yeah, there is fallout from that. And you're right. It's pretty obvious that if they want, like, they granted these guys immunity. However, I don't know. I'm torn on that because, again, I don't know exactly what their investigations revealed. But when you have Mike Fears, who's publicly stating that this has happened, and then you have guys who can break down videos of them banging drums, and you have inside shots of their clubhouse where you can see the setup that they had. It seems like there was enough evidence for them to just not automatically grant immunity. And I think Manfred's strategy of just like, well, if we put it all out there, that's the greatest punishment of all, hasn't really worked, because this is what I take exception to. One is that Manfred yesterday referred to stripping them of a title as like taking back a little piece of metal. Like, you're the commissioner of baseball. You can't just be referring to World Series titles as a little piece of metal. But secondarily, he keeps saying that the real punishment is that these guys have to live with this and these guys have to bear it with it. And it's just like, everything we hear from baseball players and everything we hear from, you know, we talked to David Sampson on Friday, is that their world is so insular that they can be protected from things. And you just look at the way that Jim Crane has already sheltered them and their responsibilities when it comes to what they've had to do with the media, or the way that Carlos Correa has handled himself in the fallout of this, which is basically lashing out at other people and throwing expletives at Cody Bellinger. And it's like, these guys don't have remorse. The one thing that you're supposed to say they have is something like they're hanging their heads and feeling bad about this thing. And yet there's no contrition. There's no public, there's nothing. It's just, basically these guys skated completely free. And Manfred continues to tell us that the punishment that they really wanted to put out there is an effective one. And it's not matching what the eye is telling us.
Right. So a couple of things. I think Manfred is going to say that what they've done is the most effective thing they could have done, even if it wasn't the most effective thing they could have done. Right. Yeah. He did say there were certain areas, you know, we didn't feel we could do this, so we only did that.
And a perfect
in terms
world,
of them
yeah.
skating. I'll disagree a little bit on that. And I am amazed. Like, Carlos Correa is a very intelligent guy, and at the beginning, he was one of the first guys in the clubhouse on the day of the Jim Crane presser where he actually said some really good things. And then when Bellinger came out firing, Correa fired back. And I couldn't believe this part. Went like at bat through at bat of the World Series in 17. Well, there was a runner at second then, so we couldn't have been doing anything. And that's unnecessary. And again, I think it's just part of it is the arrogance of the culture of the Houston Astros, which apparently has not been shattered. It's been dented, but it hasn't been shattered. But I don't think these guys are totally skating. And I'm not saying the commissioner or anybody else should hang their hats on, hey, they're getting hurt in the court of public opinion. But every columnist in America has destroyed these guys. And every road ballpark they go to this year is going to destroy these guys. It's going to be, I don't think we've ever, in my lifetime, I can't think of anything. Well, I guess like Bonds, you know, when Barry Bonds was Barry Bonds and everybody thought he was on steroids and he's approaching Hank Aaron, a lot of people were just, you know, out and out rooting against him. But this is going to be a whole team. And I don't think it matters if Jose Altuve, you know, had the banging of the drum 3% of the time and Carlos Correa had it 99% of the time. Nobody cares. Nobody's going to distinguish between that. And I think these guys are going to have a really hard year. So I would dispute a little bit that they've just skated, but I would have liked to have seen more. And by more, like, are we talking about player suspensions? Like, if Correa got 40 games and Altuve got 15 games and on and on and on down the line, would that have satisfied everybody? I don't know. I don't know what would have satisfied everybody other than maybe taking down the banner. And you know, as you know, my winter world is college basketball. Mm-hmm. And championships have been vacated. Banners have come down. I'm going to Louisville Wednesday. There's a banner that's not there for a game they played in and won when they won a championship. Jim Boeheim, in the Syracuse game notes, it says here's how many wins he has, and it's not how many wins he has, because 105 of them were taken away for recruiting violations. Michigan, like the same kind of thing. Like, I've seen banners come down, and it's something that stays with people a long time. But I don't think that Rob Manfred felt they could do that without maybe it opening up other cans of worms that weren't worth fighting for. And you know, baseball's got to wear some of this as well, because as we know now, teams went to baseball before Mike Fiers came out with this stuff. Like, teams went to baseball last year, 2 years ago, and said, hey, the Astros are doing this, and baseball never really opened up an investigation on it. So although you'll never hear baseball say it, I think baseball's got to own some of the responsibility for how far this got as well.